Hello and welcome to Volume 158 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss pore space, but not with a dermatologist. We'll find out if forests are really for the birds. We'll talk about common mistakes that forest landowners make on their taxes, and we'll investigate the story of a forest owner who discovered real estate fraud. This program is brought to you through the generous contribution of Forester Search. It's a service that makes it easier to connect landowners with consulting foresters. And you can access the site through foresterssearch.com, or there's a link on this page, and you'll be given a roster of consulting foresters that can guide you through your next steps as a forest landowner. I'm Hayes Brown with the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Our first guest is Greg Smith. He's a recently retired, but not retired, forest landowner who came, a retired physician, I should say, and not a retired forest owner, who came to our attention as a potential victim of real estate fraud, and so we asked him to relate his experience. Welcome, Greg.
Yeah, thanks, Hayes. Thanks for being here.
Could you tell us a little bit about your story and what happened to you?
Sure, I'd be glad to. I'm very appreciative for the time given here. Yeah, I'm a retired physician. I live in the Metro Atlanta area, and that will become pertinent later on is why I mentioned that. Through the efforts of my maternal grandfather, who was a county official in northern Alabama for about 30 years, he acquired different plots of timberland in predominantly in Winston County, and you know, he's since passed away. I'm in my 60s, so he's been dead for several years. And but he deeded those to me and my brother, so we do have some timberland. It's just kind of been family generational land that we've held on to, and it's managed by a forester there in the state. On Monday, about 2.5 weeks ago, I received a call from the Alabama Bureau of Investigation. The agent asked me my name, if in fact it was my name, and you know, Smith being a common name, he'd had to do a good bit of research to sort of track me down. He asked me if I had timberland in Alabama. I said I did, and he asked me if they were for sale. I said no. And he said, well, that's interesting because they're listed for sale, all the plots that you have listed for sale with a local realtor in Jasper. That got my attention, and I was very appreciative for his interest in it. So after we talked for a bit, he gave me some leads on what I can do, what I could do about that. So, you know, I've since contacted that realtor as well as a closing lawyer that she uses, and as well as recontacting that agent. And I think to reconstruct it briefly, that may be what y'all are most interested in. Apparently, the target is out-of-state landowners. I'm not sure if they target specifically people who have more than one plot of land or not, but out-of-state landowners would be ones who they would hope would be absentee, apparently. And so that was me as a target. My brother, who lives in the state of Alabama, was not targeted. This is not just in Alabama, although this was this agent's fourth or fifth case, and that's why he was interested in this. He'd had another case in Alabama recently, and it sounded similar to him when he saw all these being listed.
Let me ask you this. Were the real estate agent and the closing attorney aware when you called about this, or was this the first time they'd heard about it?
They were aware because the agent had contacted them first, but they had not been aware prior to this agent. This agent was, to me, the hero in the case, and it's a little bit unclear exactly how he tracked on to it. I've not been able to catch back up with him again, but he was the one that saw that this looked very similar to another case from a lady who lived in Texas with land locally there in Alabama who had it put up for sale. So the realtor was doing her job listing the property. She had several that she was going to go to closing on. In fact, she said she was pretty disappointed. She had done a lot of work, she and her husband, and then I called her lawyer, and he was unaware of this type of scam, and he was also unaware of this particular one. And of course, they're very concerned as well, because of the potential liability to both the realtor or the lawyer, as well as others of us.
What advice do you have? You found out about it through the Alabama Bureau of Investigation, but based on your experience, how can someone prevent themselves if they don't get a call from ABI to prevent this type of fraud?
I think being alert to the thing, that's why I'm so happy to be on this, just having information out there. I did also call the local forester that we use because he does run the land. And obviously, if he saw for sale signs, but that wasn't done in this case, that would be one thing. So the local forester, if you're a local in the state, you need to be aware that people are listing land. And the agent actually told me this has happened with houses. People have actually had their houses listed out from under them, and you know, got at least partway to closing, maybe got to escrow. I'm not sure in those cases whether they were trying to get exchange of money for the house as much as maybe escrow money or that. So I think information is number one. So the realtors now are closing a lot of these cases apparently without ever seeing the person, and I guess that's really common. She did ask for a validation of his identity and got sent a false driver's license, which had not my picture, but the wrong birth date, but the correct address, and this was what's really concerning, the correct driver's license number. That's not supposed to be able to happen. That's supposed to be pretty held on to. So the agent is looking into that, how that leaked.
Has anyone been charged with anything, or is that they've figured out who did this in the beginning?
They have not figured it out. They think it might be a Nigerian scam, and so it may not go anywhere. There is an IP address of the people who sent that that driver's license to the realtor, and they've got a subpoena on that. He's not very hopeful that's going to bring up much. But there's actually, I asked him if this could be referred to the FBI, and he said there was not a crime in terms of money exchanging hands yet. I think mm-hmm. there still is a crime with identity. I've been told I'm a victim of identity theft. I mean, my driver's license was altered and used. So that's a crime of some sort. And I did list that there's an FBI site called Internet Crimes where you can write in your complaint. And I did that, and I'm over 60. So I guess it classifies as elder scam mm-hmm. also. But yeah, that's so information from the realtors. I guess it's not possible if realtors could insist on more information. I wish she would have checked and seen my birth date did not line up with other birth dates, maybe with other things you can find on social media or that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I think the lawyers also need to be the closing lawyers because they're going to do a title search. I think they're probably both liable. Obviously, I think us landowners need to be aware that this is an issue. I have been told by a local agent here in my state that one thing that he had been suggested to, not that anybody would do this, is actually put a lien on your own property. You actually would put a lien in your own name in your property. So if that came up for sale, they would contact you and say, hey, we need to settle this lien, and that would alert you that there was a sale going on. But that seems extreme. I'm not sure that I'm recommending that. But information, number one, education information.
All right. Well, thank you, Greg. I appreciate you alerting us to that, and glad that you found out about it. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
Well, it makes sense that you can own a thing, a tangible thing, but what about the nothing that surrounds the thing? It turns out that nothing is something, and in the case of property under the ground, it's called pore space. And if you're still a bit confused, Rusty Rumley, senior staff attorney with the National Agricultural Law Center, will clear all of this up. Welcome, Rusty.
Hey, thanks for having me, Hayes.
What's pore space, and what are some of the legal issues surrounding it?
So I think everyone's familiar with mineral interests. So what the pore space is when you sink a natural gas or an oil well and you've already extracted all of those valuable minerals, it leaves openings down there in the geological formations deep in the earth. Mm. So that's at that point, you know, in the past, what's typically been done is when you have an oil well, a gas well, you know, the hydrocarbons come up, but so does a lot of ancient salt water. So there's nothing to do with that salt water. So typically what's done is they just inject it back down into the ground to dispose of it. They'll call them disposal wells. So that's typically what happens. But there's also been interest here recently with the deep sequestration of carbon dioxide. So, you know, from ethanol plants, from power plants, things like that, injecting those hydrocarbons or the CO2 back down into those deep space geological formations.
Okay. And what things should a landowner take into consideration if they have land where minerals have been extracted, there's still these pore spaces? Are they supposed to be alert to the potential marketability of this?
So that's one of the things that's a little bit tricky, and it's still fairly new. We've been disposing of things into these pore spaces for a long time. Sometimes they're just used for storage for natural gas. Like, they've got a fairly easy formation to get to. Towns, companies will actually store natural gas that's been taken from one formation, and they'll store it into a different one. Typically, it's all been tied to oil and gas exploration. There hasn't been a whole lot of marketability for that pore space. I mean, so there's some case law out there on it, but usually it's in states that kind of have a more robust history of oil and gas exploration. So think like Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, states like that.
Okay, so a little bit of precedent in mineral-producing states, but it does have application, as you say, for other products that can be stored in there. So, well, good. Well, thanks, Rusty. We appreciate your joining us.
The other thing I would mention, though, is that for the legal issues for the surface owners, I would also be looking at, it's not just who owns the mineral interest underneath it. It plays a lot into things like pipelines and easements. So this has actually been a big fight in the Midwest right now, is, you know, can these companies use the existing pipelines or put in new pipelines to transport carbon dioxide across people's land? So that's the other thing that the surface owners need to be aware of.
So maybe the minerals already been extracted, the byproducts from the minerals have been extracted, but the pore space may be considered something else that would have to be reviewed in your mineral deed or whatever you have. So, yeah.
Yep. It might be owned by either party.
Either party, right. Okay, Rusty. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Katie Greenberg is a research ecologist with the U.S. Forest Service. Dr. Greenberg has studied the impact of disturbances and how they affect bird populations, and we wanted to find out some more. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk first about fires, both wildfires and also prescribed fires in the Appalachian hardwoods. How do these type things affect bird populations?
Well, I've actually done several different studies that address different aspects of prescribed burning and wildfire. So when you piece them together, you begin to see a few patterns. I'll start with the most recent one, which is a study of the wildfires that burned in 2016 throughout much of the southern Appalachians. They were disastrous in some cases. They caused some deaths in Gatlinburg, but they also affected our forests. So scientists at CAWEDA established plots across three separate watersheds to study vegetation and water. And my colleagues and I, including Chris Borman and CAWEDA staff and some other people, we piggybacked on their design, and we looked at breeding bird populations across these three watersheds. And what we found, the wildfires burned across a fire severity gradient, meaning some of the parts of the watershed were burned at very low severity, some of them at moderate severity, and others at high severity, where a lot of trees were killed. And we also compared those burned watersheds to unburned watersheds. And what we found was the low severity burns had very little effect on breeding bird communities. It didn't affect the species that were there or how many were there. But moderate and especially high severity burns, where a lot of the trees had been killed, like up to 70% of the trees have been killed in the high severity burns, slowly and over, we studied them over a 5-year period. So initially a lot of trees were killed in the high severity burns, but more died over time. And the breeding bird communities responded to the death of those trees and the corresponding change in forest structure in those high severity burns. So where the trees were dying, a lot of shrubs and stump sprouts sprouted up and created a lot of cover for the birds, blackberry and, you know, sprouts of dead trees. And over time, that increased in the high severity burns, creating a lot of structure for these breeding birds. So So what happened was in the high severity burns where the forest structure was dramatically changed, a lot of disturbance-dependent species like indigo buntings, chestnut-sided warblers, eastern towhees, they came into these sites where they had not been before because they like open areas. And a lot of the other species that generally like forests, they didn't care. They stayed there too, which was very interesting. Only one species tends to decrease in high severity disturbances, and that's the oven bird across these studies, and maybe a few others, but the only consistently species that consistently doesn't like heavy disturbances is oven birds. But we have this influx of disturbance-dependent birds, and the other forest species did not change. So what happened was the number of species and the actual number of individual birds pretty much doubled in the high-severity burns, whereas we saw very little response in the low-severity burns.
Can I get you to talk also about other disturbances such as wind and even silvicultural changes? These are all other disturbances. How do birds react to that kind of thing?
Sure. I've done studies on low intensity prescribed fires, the kind that are normally done. Again, we see almost no response in low-intensity prescribed fires that don't kill trees. And then we also have done studies on wind disturbance where about half the trees were uprooted. And there again, we saw heavy canopy disturbance. This seems to all be associated with the level of overstory removal or disturbance that lets in light and creates that shrub response. In the wind, heavily disturbed wind sites that were disturbed by a hurricane that came inland, we saw increases in species richness and diversity and numbers of birds as well. And finally, in shelterwood harvest, we have also seen the same response where about 30% of the canopy remains and 70% taken out by timber harvest. We've seen the same response as we saw in the high severity burns, which is an influx of disturbance-dependent species and very few negative responses by most birds. Most just stayed there. And oven birds didn't like it. But one final caveat is that these forests are dynamic. They're recovering. So the shrub response is immediate, but then over time, trees start to grow up and they get bigger in girth over time because the forests are growing. And these effects, at least in the silvicultural disturbance I discussed, shelterwood harvest, lasted less than 10 years. So within 10 years in these shelterwood harvests, we saw that the number of species and the abundance of birds and the disturbance-dependent species all went back down to the same levels as we saw in the mature forest. So because these forests are dynamic and growing, the effects don't last that long.
Okay.
So the management implications would be that you need to continually have disturbances across the landscape if you want to maintain high diversity communities of especially disturbance-dependent species.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Some kind of ironic findings, but disturbances actually help sometimes with birds. We appreciate it very much, Katie. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Andrew Bosserman's a CPA and an attorney and a former IRS agent. And so after this program, be sure and check out his links to some of the complex tax topics that he is able to make simple. It's certainly worth your time. Today he'll comment on how it takes a little digging to work and master timber taxation compared with other type businesses. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks, Hayes. It's great to be here.
Why do you think there's so much confusion around timber taxation as compared to other?
Well, I think there's really probably two main reasons why timber taxes can be confusing. The first one is that forest land ownership really takes many different forms. You know, it ranges from an individual owning a few acres to much larger operations, thousands of acres. And you also have forest landowners who, are able to harvest timber regularly and almost operate their land as a full-time business or might have other related ventures. But then there's also, individuals who own the land more of an investment and use a third-party management company to manage the aspects of their land. So it really, there's a wide gamut of, what forest land ownership looks like. And depending on where you fit in there, the tax, there will be tax differences. But I think the second reason is also that, forced land ownership is different than many other businesses. You know, it takes a much longer time horizon for, you know, you to make money with your land, especially if you have to reforest and plant new trees. And also, just like forced land ownership is not well understood by the general public or even most CPAs. You know, it's really its own niche industry, and there's special tax laws that many individuals just aren't familiar with.
Sure. So, you know, if you are a little bit confused, you probably got some company, it sounds like. But what common mistakes do you see that forced landowners make involving timber taxation?
So there's three common mistakes I want to point out. So the first one is about reporting timber sales properly. So the good thing about timber sales is that they can often be taxed as a capital gain, which means you generally pay a lower tax rate than, say, ordinary income that you would pay on, say, like wages or interest income. But how you report that gain from selling your timber is going to change based on essentially how the timber is sold, whether you sell it for a lump sum or under a pay-as-cut contract, or say you even cut your own timber and, you know, transform it into logs or firewood. All of that is going to be reported differently based on how you sell the timber. So reporting that properly is extremely important. The second one is making sure you have an accurate timber basis. And basis is really just kind of how much investment do I have in the timber? And you get a deduction for that when the timber is sold. So if you purchase forest land, it's best to do this right after you purchase it because your forester can do a cruise and estimate the volumes and the estimated value. Where this gets tricky is if this wasn't done when you purchase the land, or it also gets tricky you inherit property, or if, say, the forest land is owned in an entity such as an LLC or corporation, and there's multiple owners. It gets very tricky, so you just have to be aware of those situations. And the third one is there's a special tax form called Form T, and it's related to timber. So not all forest landowners are required to file this, but if you do harvest timber every few years, or if you make one of the special elections I talked about, regarding timber sales, you do have to file the special form, which very few CPAs are familiar with, but it is timber specific, and I do find a lot of people overlook filing that form when it's required.
Okay. Well, that's three great things to look out for. Thank you, Andrew. Appreciate you joining us. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Greg Smith, Rusty Rumley, Katie Greenberg, and Andrew Bosserman. Three of the most talked about issues involving forestry are sustainability, biodiversity, and carbon storage to reduce the effects of climate change. There have been many conferences had, speakers listened to, papers written, protests organized, and intramural battles fought over these issues in the late 20th and early 21st century. Could it be that all three of these issues can be proactively addressed by one thing? Let's call it freedom. First, the assurance of sustainability was thought to be guaranteed by certification. Well, certification is thoroughly instituted in our industry, and maybe it's time to focus on something else, free and open markets. Why? Because what is valuable is cared for. Markets can create value, and where there are markets, there are products inserted into those markets, and the byproduct is sustainability. Second, what about biodiversity? Should this be achieved by a top-down model involving regulation, or can it also occur naturally as forests are owned by successive generations with diverse ideas about how to use them? So freedom of thought can also result in biodiversity. And third, carbon storage. Isn't the better option wood growing in trees and under the ground being converted into solid wood products in the built environment and repeated again and again? Wood uses 100% renewable energy as it grows and grows into a renewable product, but only as long as the owner believes that there is value and it has a market. So an argument can be made that one thing, free and open markets, can contribute greatly to the assurance of sustainability, biodiversity, and carbon storage. Sometimes the answer to the most perplexing question is right there in front of you. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.